Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reeder. My guest today is City of Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. Mayor Walsh is about to enter the final year of his second term in office, completing 8 years in that position. He's an independent, the first such mayor Syracuse has had in a century. Mayor Walsh, welcome back to the program. It's good to see you.
Thanks for having me, Grant. Nice to see you as well.
Well, let me just start. We had an election not too long ago, so I got to get your take on this, but particularly curious to get your take because as an independent, curious to hear what you made of these recent elections. Do you have any general reactions or general takes?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm still processing like everyone else. At the presidential level, I did support Vice President Harris. Obviously, she was not successful. And so, I'm preparing for a Trump administration. The good news is I've experienced that before. And so hopefully that gives us some advantage here. But the reason I supported Harris, among many, but I think most specific to this job as mayor of the city of Syracuse, is when I look at the first 3 years of my administration during the first Trump administration, we didn't get a lot of support from Washington. And contrast that with the Biden-Harris administration, they came in during the pandemic. We as a city government were reeling financially. Our largest revenue source is sales tax. And when you shut down the economy, that's really bad for business. And so the fact that the American Rescue Plan Act, or ARPA, was passed was a lifeline for us in the city. It not only helped us stop the bleeding financially, it put us in a position where we could really be proactive and make some important investments in everything from housing to infrastructure that, frankly, we weren't able to do before. You look at some other major landmark pieces of legislation, of course, the CHIPS and Science Act. We wouldn't have the Micron opportunity without that. The bipartisan infrastructure law has put us in a position to make significant investments in infrastructure from the 81 project to important water infrastructure. So I just looked at what was delivered to the city, and that was compelling enough. But again, obviously the voters felt otherwise. I'm happy. I'm relieved that it appears that it will be a peaceful transition of power. And I'm going to go into it ready and willing to work with the administration.
Yeah, I want to come back and ask you a question about the CHIPS Act in particular a little bit later. But let me stick with the election returns here for a little longer and say, so what about the elections around the city of Syracuse? Anything in the congressional elections or any of the state elections that struck you?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously we have a change in Congress and our local congressional representation. I worked hard to have a good working relationship with Congressman Williams while he was here. I think I was successful in that, and I will do the same with Congressman-elect Mannion. I've known John for a number of years, and we've had a very good working relationship. I'm excited for him and for us going into Washington. Now he is going into what will likely be the minority, and that's never an ideal position to be in for a congressman or their district. But again, I think that I'm confident that we will continue our positive working relationship, and I'm hopeful that he's able to make an impact down there. As far as the other races, no real big surprises, certainly for state representatives that represent the city. Again, I've worked real hard to have good working relationships with them, and the outstanding Senate race between Chris Ryan and Nick Perro remains to be seen, isn't over yet, but I have good relationships with both those guys. Their district doesn't include the city, but obviously I'll work to have a good relationship there as well.
It does look on that last race, though, correct me if I'm wrong, that the likelihood is that Chris Ryan will end up the winner. Is that right?
I saw he picked up a sizable advantage over the past 24 hours or so. And I think he's over 1,000 votes ahead now, maybe close to 1,500. But I think I read there's 2,800 ballots still to count. So, but yeah, I think it is looking good for him.
Yeah, we have a lot of close elections around here on those.
Yeah, that district in particular, every single time it's razor thin.
So let me shift to the city now specifically, and Just to ask you, first of all, sort of very, super open-ended question, but since the last time we spoke, what new initiatives or developments that the city is taking recently that you'd want our listeners to know about?
Yeah, you know, at this point, as you mentioned, I've got just a little more than a year left in the administration, so I'm conscious not to start too many things and really focus on finishing what we've started. So you look at some of the signature initiatives under the administration, our Syracuse Surge Initiative. You know, there's some projects within the Surge Initiative. We've done a lot of, you know, workforce development, which continues and I think is particularly important given the Micron opportunity, preparing our residents for opportunities in the new economy. Some specific projects under the Surge umbrella, the STEAM school is well underway and will open for their first freshman class next fall. The Tech Garden expansion, again, well underway and will open next year. So those are projects that have been years in the making. I'm excited they will be completed while I'm still in office. You know, I mentioned 81. That was a project that I advocated aggressively for many mm-hmm. years and is now well underway, as anyone that drives around is painfully aware of. But I'm excited about that. Also on the workforce side, you know, our Syracuse Build Initiative, making sure we have construction workers here in the city of Syracuse to work on projects like 81 and Micron. Our Pathways to Apprenticeship program associated with Build has produced, I think we've gone, there's been over 120 participants in that program, more than half of which have gone right into an apprenticeship in the trade of their choice. So, you know, workforce development, economic development, housing. We're building a lot of housing. And last year at the State of the City, I made a housing promise to get another 2,500 units completed or underway before I was done. And we're well along the way in accomplishing that. And that's everything from single family owner occupied housing to, you know, high density, mixed income, apartment rental housing. So, you know, I won't be able to get everything done, but I think for an objective observer looking at what I've committed to and what we've accomplished, I'm really proud of what we've done over the past 7 years.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Ben Walsh, the independent mayor of the city of Syracuse. One issue that has been in the news in the last month and a half or so has had to do with lead in the water. And, you know, I'm going to condense this into just one sentence. I know it's more complicated than that, but my sense is that there were these potentially erroneous reports of super high levels of lead, and that may have had to do with the way those samples were taken. It's being looked into now. Tell me what's going on with that.
Yeah, it's hard to be concise here, but I'll try. You know, the city of Syracuse is no different than any other older city with older infrastructure. I think that's been one of the challenging communication aspects of this is, you know, when compared to a city like Flint, where there was a very significant change in water infrastructure. Flint previously had their water source coming from Lake Huron. It was treated with orthophosphate, which is an anti-corrosion treatment to mitigate the impact of lead service lines. They changed that. They changed their water source to the Flint River. It didn't have that corrosion control method and had an immediate and significant impact on lead levels. For us, nothing's changed. Our water source is Skaneateles Lake, a pristine water source. Our water mains do not have lead in them. So the water traveling from Skaneateles Lake through our mains is clean and safe. Where we run into issues, which again is nothing new, is we have houses that have service lines basically from the main to the house that are made of lead. And when water is in prolonged contact with those service lines, there is the possibility that lead can leach into the water and it can be consumed. We are required by the EPA to test regularly for lead levels. Historically, it's been every 3 years. Beginning last year, the federal administration changed it to every 6 months. And during the first sampling of 2024, we had levels that were, you know, far outside of the norm of what we'd seen historically, and frankly, outside of what we've seen in our more recent testing, which we're just completing, which led us to wonder if nothing's changed. You know, why did that happen? In doing our investigation, we determined that that some of our employees did not administer the testing properly. We're still investigating that. We can't say for certain that that's the cause, but we're confident that it is. Again, that confidence is bolstered by more recent testing. The challenge is that no level of lead is safe. And the only way to completely mitigate that risk is to replace all those lead service lines. We're in the process of doing that. This administration is doing more of that than ever before, and we're on track next year to do well over 3,000. We have at least 14,000 total, which, you know, doing the math, we hope we can get through at this pace in about 5 years. The EPA requires that cities complete it in 10. We think we're going to be well below that. But, you know, for the family that has somebody in their family that's been poisoned by lead, it's important to note that by far the greatest risk comes from lead-based paint, and that's why we focused so much on that. But there is a smaller risk associated with the water, and I'm not going to sit here and tell people that, you know, they shouldn't worry about it. But I think, again, given the sampling, given the measures that we take to keep lead levels down, I feel confident saying that our water is safe, but that everyone should understand whether or not they have a lead service line. And if they do, and they're concerned about that risk, there are other ways to mitigate it. Probably the easiest way is through an appropriate water filter that they can install in their house. It's also important to run your water. If you run it for a while, the only way the lead gets into the water is if it's, again, in contact with that pipe for a prolonged period of time. So run the water for 30 seconds or so before you use it. This is a risk that, again, has existed for a long time. I grew up in a house with lead pipes. But again, that doesn't minimize what people's concerns are. And again, the long-term solution, hopefully the short-term solution, is we replace those, and we're well underway.
I remember when I lived in a house in the city there, being told to run the water for a bit before we ever used it for anything like that. So I'm glad you mentioned that. So I want to come back to something you mentioned at the beginning. I said I wanted to return to, and thinking of the future of the city, it seems to me there are two really big future changes. Some of them have started already, as you noted, with I-81. And they take the form, I think, mostly of opportunities, but they also present some challenges. And the first is that removal of I-81 and the redevelopment of the area underneath and around it. And the second one, bigger in impact, most likely, of course, is the investment by Micron to build this mega complex for chip manufacturing and clay. And you mentioned that in terms of the CHIPS Act. I mean, that one's so big that even, I have to say, some of my undergraduates have even heard of Micron. So
yeah.
They normally don't follow things in the same.
Right.
So thinking about, you know, you're in your last year, those are going to be things that the next mayor, whoever he or she is going to have to manage those things, and they're going to be huge. What do you think the next mayor needs to be keeping in mind? What will they need to have in their skill set regarding those two big things, do you think?
Yeah, I think partnerships are critically important. You have to have partnerships and good working relationships with public and private sector partners. It's hard in this job because you don't always have the same priorities, the same constituencies, but it's really critical that you maintain an open line of communication. So in the case of 81, if there's an issue or a challenge, the mayor can pick up the phone and call the New York State DOT commissioner or the governor. And I'm in a position to do that, and I'm hopeful that my successor will be as well, but also to be mindful of historical context. So with 81, you know, you have two separate but certainly related initiatives. You have the 81 project, then you have the Syracuse Housing Authority undertaking a significant transformation of their properties, which involves redevelopment, creating opportunities for existing residents to move into to newer and better units, as well as bringing in new residents at different income levels. I think that we've got the plans are sound. They are informed by history. But for those that have experienced the negative impacts of both 81 and of the associated development that happened around it, history would suggest that historically marginalized communities of color in particular, don't stand to benefit from these projects. I am very much committed, and we've gone to great lengths to change that and to ensure that not only folks that live within the shadow of the viaduct and in the housing authority properties not only are protected, but actually benefit from these investments. And again, I think that they will, but until they do, I understand that people are going to be skeptical. And again, I think it's important for any public official to understand that historical context.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with City of Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh. The independent was first elected in 2017, and he's about to enter into his final year as mayor. So, Mayor, before the break, we were talking about thinking about the next mayor and the kind of challenges that he or she will face in terms of both the redevelopment of the area under I-81 and taking down I-81, and also the huge investment by Micron. You talked about the challenges and what a future mayor will need to do on the first, but thoughts about managing the Micron investment?
Yeah, for the city of Syracuse, it's to maximize the benefit of that investment. Somewhat similar to the previous point, you know, if you look at historic investments of this scale, left to its own devices, I think under any circumstance, that type of investment is going to generally benefit the region, including the city. But I think without intentional effort, it may not move the needle on some of our most significant challenges, namely poverty. The good news is I think all partners, including Micron, are committed to maximizing that benefit and ensuring that historically marginalized populations are in a position to benefit from it. But that means, again, job training, making sure that we have city residents that are able to work on the construction, that are able to work at Micron. That's not only our workforce development programs, but again, an investment in a STEAM high school that gives our young people the skills that they need. That's going to be a real focus is making sure that our residents benefit from those opportunities. I think also on the housing front, we're going to need new housing. I think that again, there's part of the challenge in this community over decades has been sprawl without growth. We're going to have growth now. The question is, are we going to have more sprawl, or are we going to concentrate that growth in existing centers, including the city of Syracuse? That's certainly our goal. I think we have an advantage in that we are a pro-growth, pro-housing community, whereas some of the suburban communities are more, focused. NIMBYistic, if that's a word. So we're certainly trying to accelerate our investments in housing to capture as much of that that population as possible. But again, it's gonna require effort, and not just on behalf of the city, on behalf of all of our leaders.
Yeah, NIMBYistic, I think, describes where I live. So I think that word makes sense. I wanted to come back on the CHIPS Act, which you mentioned right at the beginning when we started talking. There's been some talk about a fear that this next Trump administration might try to reverse that. And of course, that was one of the fundamental pieces of legislation which made the Micron deal possible. I mean, personally, I have a hard time seeing the political logic in that, but I wanted to know if that was a concern for you.
I think until it's under construction, I think everyone's going to have some level of skepticism, and maybe that's fueled by some of the recent comments, whether it was from the president-elect or from the Speaker Johnson. But I, like you, I agree. The political calculation I think is hard to see. I also know that in speaking with Micron post-election, with County Executive McMahon, who as a Republican, I think is in a really good position to be a bridge builder there. They all feel as long as they, they're finalizing the grant agreement, it will be, everyone is on the same page, that it'll be fully executed by the time the new administration comes in. It will be really hard to get out of that. And again, I don't see the upside in it. If the president or Congress feels compelled to make tweaks to the legislation, I know they expressed some concerns around, environmental regulations, other aspects of it, perhaps they make some tweaks and then they can take credit for the investment. But I'm not overly concerned. And again, based on my conversations with Micron and other stakeholders, I don't think they are either.
Well, in preparation for this conversation I'm having with you now, I asked some colleagues over in the architecture school who have been looking at the changes and the housing development and related issues to see if they had any questions they wanted to ask you. And here's the one that they put to me. It was quite long. I don't know if that's a product of architecture people, but I'll try to shorten it. But there's obviously a lot of planned development here in the city, you know, from in all different areas of the city. Lots of different things going on. Inner Harbor, Almond Street, other parts of downtown.
Yeah.
And they noted that in other municipalities, there is often the use of an architectural review board that tries to establish guidelines and looks at proposals with the whole sort of picture of the city in mind, thinking of the entire urban environment, the beautification of the city, and all sorts of other aspects. And they were wondering why Syracuse hasn't engaged that type of system, why it doesn't have an architectural review board.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the concept. I don't think it's a bad idea. Based on where I am in my administration, I don't think you'll be seeing me advance that initiative. But I think that those architecture students should feel somewhat comforted by a number of things that are in place. The most significant being a brand new zoning code. We overhauled our zoning code for the first time in, boy, about 60 years or so in the form of rezone. And much of that zoning code, the zoning code is very prescriptive in terms of you know, land use and development, including the where the building sits on the lot and other architectural aspects of it. We also put a lot of focus on historic preservation. We have a landmark preservation board that has. Direct oversight over locally protected sites, as well as the ability to weigh in on projects that are historically significant. So we have some good measures in place right now. And I think when you look at recent development, thankfully, the years of the city building, you know, dollar stores sideways, setback from, you know, main streets, those days are over. But could we raise the bar higher in terms of, you know, architectural significance or value? I'm sure we could. It's always a balancing act when you're trying to make the projects pencil out and make sure that the numbers work, which is a challenge. But I do think that we should have a high standard. We do deserve high quality development, and always open for raising that bar further.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Syracuse City Mayor Ben Walsh. Well, we got about 4 minutes left. I want to ask one more question about the city, if I could, and then also squeeze in a couple of political questions, as I always do at the end. Yep. So going back to the city, last thing I want to talk about was gun violence and crime and safety. They were in the news a lot in the last couple of years, and the city has done a number of different things to try to address that. One of them that generated some controversy was this idea of, I believe it was taking high-risk young men, particularly in risk of getting pulled into gangs, and providing them some compensation for participating in some alternative programs. If I have that right, what is the current status of that? Because I haven't heard about it recently.
Yeah, so that initiative, which we call the Safer Streets Initiative, was launched out of our mayor's office to reduce gun violence, which I established just a couple years ago. Like virtually everything we do, it's based on best practices and research. And the reality is that when you're trying to convince individuals that are involved or at high risk of being involved in gun violence, you have to give them a reason to take a different path. And, you know, while ultimately getting them on the right track and getting them job training may lead to positive outcomes, financial outcomes, again, just to get them to take that initial step requires, you know, offering some sort of carrot. I understand why people would say, well, you know, why don't you do that for you know, citizens that are law abiding? Well, we do. Our Pathways to Apprenticeship program offers a stipend as well, acknowledging that people need to be able to get from one point in their life to another. So it was, you know, I understand people's concerns. Again, it's based on what works. We are doing that. We are underway with that program. We are seeing some early successes. The stipend has been really I guess, made into more of a a workforce development program, getting people connected to jobs. But it's underway. It's still early, but we're making progress.
Well, and just about a couple of minutes left, I want to squeeze in a couple of political questions. And this is looking at the next mayor's race. It would seem to me, I don't see another Ben Walsh on the horizon. So it would seem to me that probably the Democratic primary is going to be the de facto election if we just look at the registration numbers in the city. Do you expect to make an endorsement in this election? You've made endorsements in other elections.
Yeah.
You endorse Kamala Harris, for example.
Yeah, I do. You know, I don't always do it, and I really do it based on this, you know, the unique circumstances of the election. And while, you know, I plan on just getting out of the way when the next person takes the job, in the meantime, I want to make sure that, you know, the investments that we've made and the progress we've made are in a position to continue. You know, you mentioned gun violence. We've seen a significant reduction in gun violence in recent years. We're down double digits in terms of gun violence year over year. Our violent crime numbers are down. We're still struggling with certain property crimes, but you know, I'll use that as a way to give a shout out to our deputy mayor, Sharon Owens, who's running for mayor. You know, again, I'm not ready to do any kind of formal endorsement yet, but I couldn't think of anybody better to fill these shoes. Deputy Mayor Owens has been with me every step of the way throughout these 7 years. She's been in every room that I've made really difficult decisions. She has really sound executive leadership dating back before her time in City Hall. So I'd be hard pressed to find anybody better than her. And I think, you know, while we're certainly different people and she would do things differently, I think that she would also be in a good position to continue the progress that we've made over the past 7 years.
Oh, it would seem to make sense as your deputy. And so when do you know when you think you might make an endorsement? If you did, could you? Any estimate? I mean, no.
Not really.
Okay.
Sometime within the next year. I mean, I think we all anticipated that once this election was over, things would start to ramp up. I think, especially after the holidays, you're really going to see that. So we don't know what the field fully looks like yet, but I know Deputy Mayor Owens is in, and I think she's the one to beat. But I hope.
All right.
I hope nobody does.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll leave it there. That was Ben Walsh, Mayor Walsh. As always, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks so much, Grant. Enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest is hosted and produced by Grant Reher. The program is edited by Mark Livonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.